Welcome to TWiL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on June 19th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law.
Today, we're joined by Nicholas Bagley, a professor of law at the University of Michigan. Nick teaches and writes in the area of administrative law, regulatory theory, and health law. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be on the podcast.
As we record this, it's the height of summer, of course. Some health law professors have been teaching, some have been on vacation. Others, like you two, have been pumping out amazing scholarship. But none of us really have been able to avoid the dark cloud hovering over our chosen discipline, the expected King and Burwell decision. So in the last couple of weeks, the president's taken a few swings at the court. Secretary Burwell still denies the secret master plan for fixing things when everything goes wrong. And some in the GOP are just hoping they can get away with a two-year block grant program. And then we've already got three states looking to build out their own exchanges. So are either of you prepared to say anything today that you won't regret saying when the opinion comes down at the end of the month?
I'm certainly prepared to say that I genuinely hope the Supreme Court makes what I regard to be the correct decision and upholds the IRS rule. I think at a minimum, the Affordable Care Act is ambiguous about whether or not subsidies are available in those states that decline to establish state-based exchanges, and I hope the court recognizes as much.
Right, so then under the very basic Chevron analysis, this is something that they ought to be deferring to IRS, HHS on. Is that the essential argument?
Yeah, I think that's the strongest argument that the government is presenting. It went into the Supreme Court saying, we think we've got the best and indeed the only available construction of the statute. But the fact is, the language of Section 36B of the Internal Revenue Code, which the ACA added, that language is, it's not terrific for the government. And I think at a minimum, I think their stronger argument is the fallback that, look, at least it's ambiguous, and if it's ambiguous, you ought to defer to the IRS's authoritative construction. One interesting wrinkle to notice about that is that if the Supreme Court does side with the government, it's reasonably likely to do so on that theory, which would, in principle, open the door to a future Republican president changing the rule. After all, the idea is that the rule is that the statute's ambiguous and is amenable to two possible interpretations. The IRS could potentially revisit its decision and recreate the kinds of problems that we now face if the Supreme Court were to side with the plaintiffs.
That is such a great thing to remind everyone involved about, and it's something I often hit in my administrative law course, is that, you know, something that can seem like a real godsend at time one can be quite unnerving at time two. Thank you.
Yeah, I think, I'll just say that, you know, it's another reminder, if we needed any more reminders, that elections have consequences.
So one little point, Nick, that I remember discussing with you briefly over Twitter a couple of months ago or more, that I know the court will not reflect on. It's not before it, obviously, as an issue. And that is sort of what the president was alluding to last week or so, when he said that the court really shouldn't have taken this. And I remember asking the question on Twitter whether they should have done, because after all, there wasn't a circuit split. We were sort of waiting for the Indiana case in all likelihood in the Seventh to create that. What's the situation on that and the court taking the case even though there wasn't that split?
Yeah, well, the court's rules indicate that it should consider taking cases where there is a circuit split, and the Supreme Court should come in and clean up the mess that exists in the circuit courts. But it also has a provision saying that the court should grant cases that haven't been but should be authoritatively resolved in the Supreme Court. And, you know, I'm of the view that the court should have declined cert here because the Fourth Circuit, which is the case that they took, got this case right. And the D.C. Circuit, which originally held that the IRS rule was invalid, that decision had been vacated, and the case was well on its way to an en banc reconsideration by the full court, which, given the composition of the court, would almost certainly have led to upholding the IRS rule. So I thought the court's intervention was unnecessary because this wasn't an issue that the court needed to visit, because the lower courts were going to come to the correct conclusion. had already or were going to. That said, if I were convinced, and I think several members of the court at least are convinced, that the Fourth Circuit got it wrong, I'm not sure there's any there's anything in principle that suggests they did something wrong in granting the case. The Supreme Court exists to correct substantial errors in the lower courts. It doesn't do so all that often, but it can, and it does. And I admit to thinking there's nothing inherently problematic about that. Again, I think where I part ways with the justices who voted to grant cert is their, what I think is fair to say, is their implicit view that the Fourth Circuit got this case wrong.
So let's move from the past, we hope, the Affordable Care Act, to your wonderful new article, which is about to come out in the Michigan Law Review. Medicine as a Public Calling is its title, and we'll make sure it's linked in the show notes. In that article, you say, and I quote, "Now that the Affordable Care Act has eased public concerns about the uninsured, the serious economic challenges facing those with insurance are likely to become salient. Should the ACA fail to remedy a number of disturbing practices in the medical marketplace, policymakers may find public utility regulation increasingly attractive." And I wonder if you could lead us through your reasoning on that, and I guess deal with, for me, a fairly fundamental question, which my sense of the Affordable Care Act is that in the way it has harnessed private insurance, in large part, to deal with the access issue, I wonder whether, in fact, the Affordable Care Act points in the opposite direction to the one that you start discussing in your article, and that, in fact, it is a commitment to base healthcare on private health insurance markets or sort of public entitlements that are shaped to resemble private insurance to an extent.
Yeah, I think that's a terrific point. And in fact, that's really the insight that led me to the paper. So I do think the Affordable Care Act is built out on market principles. It's a regulated marketplace. The health insurance, the market for healthcare is sufficiently difficult that any kind of insurance market that's going to be successful is going to have to be subject to some kinds of regulations, like the regulations against discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions and the requirement to write insurance for all comers and the like. I think it's safe to say that the Affordable Care Act doubles down on a market-based approach, and on the exchanges at least, and really throughout the employer-based system, it pins its hope in particular to this idea of managed competition, the notion that you'll put a bunch of insurance companies into the market and they'll negotiate hard with providers, physicians, and hospitals to drive down prices, to improve the quality of care, and the like. We've had managed competition in this country in a fairly robust form for at least the past 20 years, and it's had kind of a mixed record. It hasn't reduced the galloping pace of medical expenditures to anything like the rate that would be sustainable. And it's created lots of pushback from individuals on the ground who dislike the methods that these insurance companies, these managed care organizations use to regulate the consumption of healthcare. So I guess the paper grew out of it was really an extension of the question of what happens next? What happens if this doesn't work? You know, I think it's important to bear in mind that we're really the only country that does it quite like this, which is to say that we're engaging in a nationwide experiment with managed competition. And again, the track record of managed competition is not not unblemished. So the question is, what do we do if this gambit doesn't work? Where do we go from there? What's left? And the inside of my paper, such as it is that we're probably not going to go to a single-payer system, which is, I think, the dominant approach on the left. Nor do I think we're going to see a redoubled recommitment to the market, an evisceration of the regulations that are on the books, or a repeal of Medicare and Medicaid, and going back to some pure embrace of the free healthcare markets. I think what we're quite likely to see is something a little bit more top-down and regulatory. And the reason I think we're going to see it is because that kind of top-down economic regulation of the healthcare industry is actually something that's pretty deeply baked into health law. We tend to overlook it because I think there's a broad political consensus that market-based approaches are at least presumptively appropriate, and I share that consensus. But I think we, by indulging that consensus, or perhaps by trimming our sails, given our recognition that a lot of these top-down economic-type regulations are political non-starters, for those reasons, we tend not to think about a variety of techniques that are used across the developed world to constrain healthcare costs. Pretty much every other country regulates healthcare as a kind of utility. They regulate market entry and exit. They impose hard and fast non-discrimination rules. They assure that the prices that are charged to people who get care are equal to, you know, depending on the kind of care that these people receive. And maybe most importantly, most of these countries in one form or another actually regulate, actually set prices for healthcare. Now, my claim is not that we're going to go whole hog and embrace a public utility model through and through. We never have. But my claim is to say that if you look across the 20th century, you actually see in the healthcare space each of these techniques used on a fairly wide scale. They've receded somewhat since the early 1980s, but we've seen it. And if we used to regulate medicine in this way, and if the hoped for benefits of managed competition don't pan out, then I think we may find ourselves reverting to that older style of regulation. What seems perhaps unthinkable today may become more thinkable. Now, whether that's a good or a bad thing, I frankly don't know, and I really intended the piece to be much more descriptive than normative. Descriptive in the sense of saying, look, we have a deep regulatory tradition here in the United States of treating lots of industries as public utilities. It turns out that we don't just treat the conventional natural monopolies like energy or water as natural monopolies, but we treat much more as natural as public utilities, and that healthcare is a pretty clean fit for at least the way we've typically thought about when public utility regulation is appropriate. So, you know, I do want people to at least consider it as a possibility. Don't discard it out of hand, but think hard about whether the difficulties associated with public utility regulation outweigh the benefits. It may. And try to figure out whether what the most prudent path is forward without sort of any kind of pre-commitment to a particular ideological approach. You come at this as a technocrat. What can we do to actually achieve our public goals? And if managed competition is and isn't it, I think something that sounds in the public utility tradition might be.
I do really appreciate the technocratic angle on the problem. And I think it's very... I can see this type of article really finding a great reception among the big think tanks that are in D.C., that are at the center of a lot of these policy debates, at health affairs, at other areas. I wanted to ask one question to start off with, which comes from my experience, not necessarily in the health area, but as someone that about 5-7 years back was writing about net neutrality, back when it seemed like it was going to be a big dream, and now it seems to have come through. But one thing I remember in writing about net neutrality is a lot of the folks who were on the side of the telecom industry, the cable industry, said, look, the more you treat the internet like a utility, the more you're going to drive investment away from this dynamic area of the economy. We're seeing a little bit of that type of rationale in the healthcare area now with the efforts to repeal the medical device tax. Do you think that these types of fears about driving away investment are legitimate? Or do you think that this is just a way of, say, getting investment in the healthcare sector that's less equity and more, say, debt fixed income based?
Yeah, so I guess I think about it, if we as a public decide that we are spending too much on healthcare, that our consumption is outpacing the value we get from it. And there are a lot of people, not everyone, who feels this way, who believe that we're spending more for our healthcare than the value we're getting and would prefer to devote fewer societal resources toward the healthcare sector. But for a variety of reasons having to do with market failure, having to do with political power, having to do with antitrust issues that pervade the healthcare industry. For a variety of reasons, we've really struggled to try to bring that, our healthcare spending in line with other developed nations and in line with what is, you know, people's intuitive sense of good value for their money. So, you know, would reducing the amount that we spend over time on healthcare dry up investment? I think it's safe to say that it would discourage investment, at least on the margins. But that would be the point, I think, to say we're actually, we as a public believe we are investing too much, that our individual consumption choices are not amounting, you know, are not, in fact, the kind of free choices that we typically make in a well-functioning market, but are problematic gauges for how much we are spending overall. So, you know, somebody's, the vice of not spending, of not investing as much in the healthcare industry is really part of the virtue of a proposal along these lines. And I'll say another point, which is, you know, one of the really big challenges in healthcare is, you know, everyone believes in innovation. Nobody wants to stifle innovation. But right now, what we get is a really perverse kind of innovation. Because we cover all medically necessary care, and because managed care companies do almost nothing to discourage the use of any medically necessary care, we end up encouraging manufacturers to develop solutions that are 1% better, but that cost 10 or 100 times more. And that kind of an innovation means that's what technology companies are investing in, that 1% solution. What we don't see as much investment in are in those solutions that can do the same, provide the same health benefit, but for much cheaper. We don't see the innovations that are targeted toward cost reduction. And so it's possible that what we want to think about is not how to reduce innovation or not how to reduce investment, but how to assure that the kind of innovation we get is the kind of innovation we want. Whether public utility regulation is well designed to get at that, I don't know. I suspect we may need something more, but it's at least something to think about, and a perversity in the current system that I think managed competition is going to struggle to get at.
Got it. And I just wanted to also just add a little bit to the amount of GDP, say, devoted to healthcare, because I do read the Incidental Economist, where I think you've got some great posts, and I read the stuff by Carol and Fracht and Kevin Adderson over there. And I do see a consensus there usually around the idea that healthcare costs need to go down. But I thought, just for our listeners' sake, they might be interested in the perspective of David Cutler. I think in at least one of his works has said, you know, for a few decades out, is he really concerned if U.S. healthcare takes up 25% of a developed country's economy? It's now about 17-18% in the U.S. And he shrugged, said it really wasn't that much of a concern. Given steady productivity growth. William Baumol, in his book on the cost disease, even extrapolates out to 2105 and has a scenario where 68% of U.S. GDP is healthcare, and spins a story saying that that's not that big a deal either. So it is interesting to see the sort of the diversity of perspectives out there on, say, having a rising share of GDP. But the other question I was going to ask, and something that sort of is more on the policy side, is as I read your paper, and I love the invocation of comparative health policy, that was really insightful, but what was always in the back of my mind was comparing it to the 2004 FTC DOJ Dose of Competition report, or maybe that was just the FTC, and I think David Hyman was sort of a big author behind that and did a lot of the work behind it. And I would just love to hear your reflections, Nick, on sort of the evolution in health policy over the past 10 years. I think 10 years ago, we were really, all the movement in D.C. was, how do you make healthcare a more perfect market? And I think your paper, your article could be this high watermark in sort of a swing of the pendulum away from that idea.
I think that is emphatically my hope. So for the listeners who don't know, David Hyman is a sort of libertarian-oriented, very conservative healthcare analyst. He's a delightful person and wonderfully smart. And he was one of the, I actually presented this piece at the school, at University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, which is where David teaches. So he was one of the early readers in this piece, and you can imagine he wasn't, I think, terribly happy with it. But what I think, you know, I hope this piece can speak to people like David who are committed to competition in the healthcare sector, because it's a way of saying, look, if you think this managed competition thing is maybe the best way we can sort of bring market forces to the healthcare system, then it's incumbent on you to make sure it works well. And that means you've got to think hard about the problems that are associated with managed competition. If you believe in managed competition, then you better believe in the vigorous enforcement of the antitrust laws. Because right now, the big problem with managed competition is that these providers out there, these integrated medical systems, in many markets wield extraordinary power, power in many cases to set their prices. So how can a market work where you have that kind of antitrust concentration? So I view this as sort of a way of saying, look, like this is, you know, you may not like the Affordable Care Act, but it at least embodies the basic principles that, you know, this market approach is based on. You may think it goes too far, and I'm happy to work with people to try to tinker, at least on the margins, to try to figure out how to make it more responsive to market-based concerns. But if it doesn't work, what else do you have? What comes next? So when I think about the pendulum swinging, it is really interesting to go back historically. Back in the 1970s, it's important to remember, we actually regulated the rates that hospitals could charge all payers. We said, this is how much you can charge, this and no more. And there's been a kind of erasure of that approach from public memory. And those rate-setting schemes in the States went away, not because they had been demonstrated to be ineffective, but because we embraced this idea of managed competition. We said, regulators shouldn't be doing this. Insurance companies should be doing this in negotiation with providers. And so those rate-setting bodies withered on the vine. And I think you can really date it back to about 1980. You see a real rise in skepticism of these sort of centralized economic regulation. And you can see a concerted pushback. And it's a pushback that I think has really extended across the ideological spectrum and is now sort of the median view within the left as well, that, you know, we're going to try this market-based approach. Those people on the left who object to it sort of point towards single payer, but I think a shift to single payer is very difficult to achieve in this country, much more difficult than just eliminating the Affordable Care Act. And so I think we may see, as you say, a swing of the pendulum back toward this kind of regulation. I remember one of the things that I loved when I found it in the course of writing this paper was a report from 1980. And it's the title of it, it's from the Institute of Medicine, so, you know, an important organization in Washington, and it's titled Health Planning in the United States. And it is literally unfathomable to me that you would have a government report that is titled anything like that. And what's wonderful about this report is that one of the real advocates, early advocates of a market-based approach to healthcare, Clark Havokhurst, Clark has this wonderful separate writing in this report saying, you know, competition is the way of the future, and you guys aren't paying attention to the shifting winds. And I think he was exactly right. But I do now wonder if there may be a shift back, and perhaps we see a leading edge of that in the move to net neutrality in the FCC space. And perhaps we're going to see a little bit more of that in Massachusetts, which is a little bit further ahead than most states with this universal coverage thing. And we may see it in more and more states over time. Or we may not. I may be completely mistaken.
You give some examples, Nick, of some prior public utility style healthcare regulation we've seen. You talk about Hill-Burton, EMTALA. If I may, I might even add HIPAA as a data regulating kind of model to that list. Looking forward and sort of maybe to the next article, does your conception of public utility regulation here, is that limited to price or rate regulation? Or, you know, would you go further and look at things like the drug reference pricing that we have now in Germany, or the regulation of treatment modalities and drug cost effectiveness we see from the NICE agency in the UK? Do you have any sort of concept of you know, the public utility style regulation that we might be looking at, or is it too early to ask that question?
Well, the paper doesn't do a ton of speculating, in part because I think it is early and difficult. And although what came before, you know, what's passed is often prologue, I think it's safe to say that any public utility regulation we see today would look quite different than the sort of regulation we had in the past, and appropriately so. What I can say is that, you know, this idea of the public utility regulation grew up during the progressive era, and when it was developed, really was a pretty well understood regulatory technique. And there were four aspects to it. When an industry was designated as a public calling or a public utility, it was incumbent upon the state to assure that the industry provided its services or goods in an economically fair manner. And that entailed four separate obligations that were placed on the use of on the industry's use of its own private property. And those were pretty well understood. So the first was that you had to accept all comers. And you see this reflected in EMTALA, where anybody who's suffering from an emergent condition can receive treatment at any emergency room that accepts Medicare funding. You had to accept all, charge everyone who came the same price. You couldn't discriminate against one person because you preferred to treat other sorts of individuals. You had to make sure as an industry that you provided an adequate supply of services. You couldn't just wield your economic power by, you know, sending just one or two train cars to an area that needed a whole lot more in terms of supply. And we see this kind of concern with supply reflected in Hill-Burton, and more significantly, I think, in certificate of need regulation, which is still quite pervasive across the country. And finally, you do see rate regulation. Not in all sectors. It was even understood back in the progressive era that rate regulation was sort of the last-ditch effort. You would hold off as long as you could. But if the unfairness in the market sector was sort of something you otherwise couldn't get at, rate regulation was thought to be entirely appropriate. So at a high level of generality, I can say that what we're concerned about here is economic exploitation, and any set of regulations that dealt with such exploitation by impinging on the industry's ability to use its private property as it saw fit, that would sound in a public utility tradition. So would reference pricing sound in a public utility tradition? Well, it could. A reference price for a good or a service is a fixed price that a payer is willing to pay for a given good or service. In that sense, it's actually quite similar to rate setting. And what it does is allow a patient to pay out of pocket for a good or service that exceeds the reference price, which essentially, you know, allows, another way of, fancy way of saying it, allows balanced billing over the reference price. I think you are likely to see it in the drug space. In fact, there are times when I think that the drug space might be the place that you start seeing this first. You know, we've had so much outcry over the excessive costs, or supposedly excessive costs, of Sovaldi and Harvoni, the new Hep C drugs. We've got some new drugs to regulate cholesterol coming on the market, which are going to be exceedingly expensive, and they're going to find, if they pass FDA approval, an enormous market. So when people start feeling like they are being exploited by industries that don't have market restraints on the amount that they're charging, I think you may start seeing them demand effective solutions. And rate regulation, clumsy as it may be, is one way to get at that. Again, I'm not saying that would be a good idea, but I am raising questions about whether we've got anything else in the hopper that we can do instead. And what's interesting, too, I should finally round out, is saying one of the ways you see public utility regulation playing out across the 20th century is that the state says, look, this is where we're going if we don't get industry to play ball with us and to come up with other techniques to reduce the kind of exploitation that the public is seeing. So it's possible that public utility regulation will be the, you know, if it becomes more credible, will be the fist in the glove that actually never needs to be used, but nonetheless exerts pressure on the market.
And one question that I wanted to add about the, you mentioned Sovaldi and some of the current controversies. One of the things I found really interesting towards the end of your article, The Medicine is a Public Calling, was looking at some of the state's efforts to rein in costs. I had previously heard a lot of disparaging commentary in this area saying, oh, you know, these rate reviews don't have any teeth, and it doesn't really seem as though they're going to end up really deterring big increases in costs. But you point out in Massachusetts, which is a state that has had, was 4 years ahead in terms of trying to get near universal health insurance coverage for its population, there have been some very interesting developments with some jawboning or bargaining between state officials and the Partners Health Plan, which is often seen as the, which is the most expensive often, it appears, and is often seen as must-have hospitals for plans. So I was wondering if you might comment on what was going on in Massachusetts and how that might end up influencing health policy nationwide.
Yeah, so one of the things that I thought was interesting is, you know, we have this sort of natural experiment in Massachusetts, which, as you say, is about 4 years ahead of the rest of the country. And I thought it was really important to take a look at what was going on in Massachusetts, in part because although we tend to think about the federal government when we tend to think about healthcare policy and healthcare reform, and I think that's a function partly of our general federal focus, but also partly a function of the Affordable Care Act, which consumed so much attention and which is playing out, at least in large part, on the federal level. There's so much attention to the federal that a lot of times we forget about the important role that the states can play. And there's a lot of heterogeneity among the states in their appetite for economic regulation, and maybe more importantly, a lot of heterogeneity among the states in the efficacy, in the how well-functioning their markets are. Some states have a lot of insurers selling on the exchange and a fairly robust set of providers that are in competition with each other, but lots of states don't. And so you might see different states trying to explore different possibilities for what they might do to bring down healthcare spending. Massachusetts is a great example because, as you say, there are some dominant players, including Partners Healthcare, in Massachusetts. And in the past, the basic rule when it comes to acquisitions has been that we've looked the other way. And we've looked the other way in part because we think, or we hope, that consolidation in the healthcare industry might lead to the kind of integration that will improve the quality of care, especially for those with chronic conditions. So we've been adopting policies to promote consolidation, even though those policies also raise concerns that the very large, powerful providers will be able to wield substantial market power and make it difficult for market competition to work. What you saw in Massachusetts was the creation of what they called the Health Policy Commission. And the Health Policy Commission was designed to oversee whether acquisitions in the state were appropriate. They were designed to oversee when providers failed to meet certain targets for overall healthcare growth. And there were big questions about how effective this Health Policy Commission was going to be. Would it be just a paper tiger, or would it actually exert some power? And in their first big test, they offered an enormous rebuke to Partners Healthcare, which had proposed to acquire a hospital system, a new hospital system, and a physician network. And the hospital commission said, nope, not on our watch. And they referred the Partners Healthcare to the Attorney General for potential antitrust violations. The Attorney General worked out a deal with Partners, negotiated a deal with Partners, whereby Partners would be allowed to go ahead with the acquisitions but would agree to certain sorts of price controls to assure that the prices that it charged to its to people who came to its hospitals and physicians weren't getting charged disproportionately. And since that sort of first rebuke of Partners, we've seen some additional activity on the part of the Health Policy Commission to sort of at least try to nibble at the margins of the problems in Massachusetts. Now, I don't think anybody believes that the Health Policy Commission is enough to forestall spending growth in Massachusetts, but I do think it's an indication of the kind of economic oversight and, right now, fairly soft, but nonetheless meaningful regulation we could see develop organically. One of the things I like to point out to folk is that, you know, just a decade ago, we had very few of what we call these all-payer claims databases. These are entities that collect pricing data from insurance companies about the amount that they're being charged for the various services that their insureds get. One of the recurring problems, of course, is that it's very difficult to get pricing data from insurance companies. They view it as proprietary, and even though that data is obviously helpful and important. And so these all-payer claims databases have over the past decade grown up, and what you have now are institutions that collect information about prices that are set all over the state. And these are very similar to the sorts of commissions we had back in the 1970s in many states, some of which we used for rate regulation. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if we saw these all-payer claims databases start, maybe slowly, to move into that space.
Well, our time is coming to an end, but just before we go, a quick question with regard to some follow-ups, really, on some of the stories that we've been following over the last few weeks. While Frank and I have been away from the microphones, we're still waiting on new, ever-promised drafts of the 20th Century Cures Package. Over in Europe, the EU privacy regulation that we discussed recently with Leslie Francis has now emerged from the Council of Ministers, the EU Member States Justice Ministers, and I think after a bit of what we'd call reconciliation or conferencing, it should be a legislative go in about a year. And then over the last sort of week again, the TPP that Frank talked about a couple of episodes ago has had its downs. It got roundly defeated, and now it looks like it's having an up as the GOP comes to rescue the president. I wondered very quickly, gentlemen, which do you think of those three stories we'll still be talking about a lot in 6 months' time or a year's time?
I'll jump in for the TPP just because I'm part of a group of legal academics like Margot Kaminsky and Amy Kepchinsky and Dave Graywall. They're trying to sound the toxin so that folks realize that this is a very, very important issue. It also includes things like the Trade and Services Agreement. And when we look at the long sweep of changes to law, as someone who's formerly taught intellectual property law, we've seen repeatedly the ways in which, say, international law unexpectedly upended the hopes for certain reforms or changes to that law. And what I hope folks in general will realize, and especially in the healthcare area, is that we could be sort of sleepwalking as a nation into a scenario that will really freeze into place legal regimes that are quite disadvantageous. And I think that's one of the wonderful contributions of your article, Nick Bagley, is that you show just how important policy innovation has been over the past several decades. And I think that the more we learn about the importance of policy innovation and change, the more we have to be suspicious of international regimes that sort of freeze in place one particular vision of society.
On the 21st Century Cures Act, there is actually a fair amount of debate about one set of its provisions, which is designed to help providers share more easily information related to substance use disorders that their their patients face. Right now, there's a very robust privacy law in the books that makes it very difficult for providers to disclose to each other that they're treating somebody with a substance use disorder, and that obviously complicates treatment when you have somebody who's seeing multiple providers. So the 21st Century Cures Act is sort of a step in that direction, but I think what you might see is an important and difficult fight over medical privacy, one that I think is likely to play out not only in the context of the 21st Century Cures Act, but along a wide array of dimensions over the next decade or two.
And not surprisingly, I'll take the third choice, which is the EU privacy regulation. I think that will confirm the center of gravity of privacy regulation and regulatory innovation as existing in Europe, the repercussions for some of our trade policies and so on will be really quite severe. So that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Nick Bagley, who is at Nicholas_Bagley on Twitter and also blogs at The Incidental Economist. Nick, thanks so much for joining us.
I was delighted. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So we post our show notes at twill.com. That's TWIHL.com. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry, and that's the Nicholas without the H, NicolasTerry, on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found?
I am both at Frank Pasquale on Twitter, and for health tweets only, just go to HealthPI on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.